when it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, it's Riona Duncan, and I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman to talk about banned books on Forbes Avenue, and this is on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The reason I'm talking with Professor Newman about banned books is because you run a banned books class. So how did you end up offering that class?
I don't remember what the initial inspiration was. I think the original title was Censored Texts. But starting about 20, 25 years ago, I just got interested in the phenomenon, and I noticed that it was happening more and more. And then I got interested in the history of it. And every time you poke at a case of book banning, you find something different and you find something interesting. So I taught the class originally. I had like a set of texts that would change. And the students would write papers on what we were reading. And then 6 years ago, I changed to the format I have now, where students do original, in-depth, high-quality research on a single case of book banning. And I found that CMU students really rose to the occasion and did really good work. So I'm enjoying this new format.
What would you say you've learned from having this class?
It is so cool to see what students are interested in. I have students from all over the world, and so a lot of students want to work on books that were banned in their home country. So China, a student came up to me today and said she wanted to do a play that's been banned in Colombia. So I learn about books from all over the world. That's one super cool thing. And then I think students who choose books that have been banned more recently, I've helped students do things like find the video of the school board meeting where the book was banned. And so just getting to see human beings in action doing this thing that we kind of think of as nefarious or behind closed doors, like actually being able to see the school board meeting where it happened is really cool.
So you were talking about the trend that you noticed 25 years ago. Would you say that it still holds? Are we banning more books than we ever have?
I don't remember what I was inspired by 25 years ago exactly, but certainly since 2019, 2020, there has just been like a hockey stick graph. Like it is like right now, I would say is probably the most challenges in American history are happening to books right now. The group that really tracks that is PEN America. They come out with a report every 1 to 2 years. And so they're just showing that there's more and more parts of the country and more kinds of books and more different kinds of people who are challenging books. So I think I came up with the idea for this class, and now it's really more relevant than ever before.
So I know there's a lot of people trying to combat that with social media, online library cards, that kind of thing.
Yes, I think sometime in the last couple of years, maybe the Brooklyn Public Library made it possible for anybody in the country to get a library card there, and then they could get electronic books or audiobooks. So I think, I mean, here, this is one of the ironies. In some ways, information has never been more accessible, more available, cheaper. And so it kind of raises the question, why challenge a book if somebody can just get it some other way? What is the political capital that's being expended to say, I want this book out of this public library, or I want this book out of my kid's curriculum, or I want this book out of my kid's library? So I think the questions are in some ways more vexing now, because it just begs the question. And also, if you hand your 12-year-old a smartphone, why are you also trying to take a book out of that 12-year-old's classroom? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, although people on both sides of the political argument have decided to ban books for various reasons.
Definitely. There's not like one political group that has a monopoly on saying, I don't want my kid to read this book, or I don't want any kids to read this book. But there has been a more easy to track movement from American political conservatives since the Reagan era, and especially in the last 5 years. After Trump lost the 2020 election, there was an attempt by sort of the movement that was around Trump to attack school boards and to sort of take on cultural issues. And so critical race theory, books by diverse authors, books by queer authors, those books really started to come under attack kind of in the wake of that presidential loss.
So one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, beyond this being a great topic, is that we do have Banned Books Week coming up in late September. Do you feel like that celebration helps counteract this push towards book banning, or does it possibly kind of not do enough?
Yeah, there's a real irony that's present in both book banning and book defending. Banned Books Week was the brainchild of a librarian from Pittsburgh. Her name was Judith Krug, and she was she worked for the American Library Association, and she went to the American Booksellers Association and said, you know, we're seeing this uptake in challenges. Why don't we band together and promote the idea that we should have the freedom to read? And so at a big book convention in 1982, there was the first kind of celebration or recognition of banned books. And there's been one every year since 1982. I think the irony is that every year when Banned Books Week comes around, somebody writes an article that says there's no such thing as a banned book in America. And it's true that it's incredibly rare that any governmental agency will ever take action against a book. We don't live in a totalitarian country where you could be jailed for what you write, at least not today. And so there's some irony that the presence of Banned Books Week tends to sort of incite opposition to the use of the term banned books, and to the whole kind of, people say it's hysterical, it's sort of pearl clutching, it's much ado about nothing. At the same time, there's another ironic reaction, is that oftentimes when a book is targeted and then that target is publicized, that increases sales of the book. So the graphic novel Mouse was challenged by a Tennessee school board in January of 2022. And almost as soon as it was publicly known, that book just started flying off the shelves and they had to print some extra runs. So I think there's just irony on both sides. When you overtly try to defend books, you get attacked for sort of exaggerating the state of book banning. When you attack books, you often inadvertently promote them. There's an action and an opposite reaction that happens in both moves, both challenging and defending.
Given you've been studying banned books and teaching about them for so long, what would you say causes people to challenge them, especially when this causes such a counterswing to the other direction?
I mean, I think the positive that I see in book challenging is that it's a reminder, and a really happy reminder for me, because I'm an English professor, that books are powerful, that books incite strong emotions, that they make people want to do something, even if that thing is to close the book and try to take it away from other people. So I think it's evidence that in this kind of information-saturated world, we still value books and we still find them to be life-changing in a certain way. I think the other thing that I notice is that the internet and social media, I think, has allowed people to organize and exchange information at a much higher rate. So, for example, The Grapes of Wrath was banned by Kern County, California in 1939. And there was like a little 2-inch newspaper squib about it. And that newspaper squib got reprinted on a wire service. And so then a few other county libraries and city libraries took up the challenge and said, yes, we agree. We think Grapes of Wrath is offensive and we're going to ban it. In some cases, there's one library that burned it. They had a ceremonial burning of it. So the newspaper was kind of the viral media of the day. Today, if somebody challenges a book, it's often part of a list that circulates through political groups. There's a conservative political group called Moms for Liberty that has chapters in different states. And then book defenders also are organized on state levels. So there's ACLU chapters in many, many American cities. So I think what I'm noticing is that in some ways, even though it's probably more futile to challenge a book than ever before, people can share information about what books to target and how to attack them. It's easier to share that information than it's ever been in the history of books.
Would you say that graphic novels, for example, you mentioned Mouse, are especially easy to target with this then?
Absolutely. I mean, graphic novels are targeted, you know, I don't remember what the percentage differential is, but it's at a much greater rate than books that just have words on the page. I do think there's a famous judge who said, I don't know what art is versus pornography, but I know it when I see it. So we somehow trust our eyes to tell us if something is offensive or bad or wrong. And that visual information, we believe that we can adjudicate it in a way that we somehow maybe don't feel like we can adjudicate the written word in the same way. So graphic novels are constantly under attack. Anne Frank is a frequently banned book, The Diary of Anne Frank, but the graphic novel of The Diary of Anne Frank, banned and challenged even more. Things having to do with the Holocaust, like Mouse, Diary of Anne Frank, those have really been hot button books in recent years. Other graphic novels that are under attack, genderqueer, coming of age memoir about a non-binary author. The most banned book in America, basically since the day it was published.
You mentioned that Holocaust and queer issues are a hot topic. Is there anything else that tends to be banned?
One of the people that we study in my class is one of the top banned book researchers in the U.S., and her name is Emily Knox. She teaches at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So she's just a fantastic scholar, and she has a wonderful article about how when books get challenged, it tends to be diverse books that get challenged. And what she means by diverse books is books by authors who are considered to have some kind of marginal identity in that moment or in some past historical moment. So books by women, books by African-American authors, books by queer authors, books by Native American authors, Asian American, Indian American, Latino American, those books tend to be the most targeted. And Knox, I don't know if she would call herself a free speech absolutist, but she would really challenge anybody who wants to ban books because her argument is ultimately if when bans and challenges go forward, they tend to fall on the text written by more marginal authors more than any other kind of author. So you might think, oh, I don't want To Kill a Mockingbird taught because the author used the N-word. But then it turns out that most books that are banned for the use of the N-word are written by African-American authors. So you might think that you have the best intentions when you're trying to get a book out of circulation, but the end result is that the people who get silenced are the people that we really need to hear from the most.
Thank you so much. I'm Riona. I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman talking about banned books. So I wanted to situate banned books in the larger context of free speech. How do banned books and free speech go hand in hand, do you think?
I love that question because I always start the class with the First Amendment. And I think that when students hear the word free speech, and if they haven't had to do AP Gov or, you know, some really intensive civics course, you just think, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want. And the First Amendment is 45 words, and not that many of those words are about free speech. And all it says is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the speech. And that actually isn't very specific and doesn't actually give you the freedom to say whatever you want. It only says that Congress shall make no law. So I really like to think about how kind of weird those 45 words are and how limited they are in terms of what we know how to do with them. One thing that is really shocking to me right now is how many state legislatures are passing laws against books. And the 1619 Project has been banned by at least a dozen state legislatures across the country. So I haven't seen any of those cases go up to the Supreme Court, but I sort of can't believe that we are actually passing laws against books, even despite the First Amendment. And I don't know if a state legislature is, I guess, distinct from Congress, but I honestly just don't understand it, can't figure it out. But I think that the openness, the vagueness, maybe the simplicity of the First Amendment does give us a real opportunity to think about what it means to have free speech and what the American Library Association calls the freedom to read. The ALA has a Reader's Bill of Rights or Library Bill of Rights that I teach in the class, and I can't recite it chapter and verse, but the basic idea is that you have the freedom to receive information. And I think that is much more comprehensive than simply the idea that Congress shall pass no law. Because if I have the freedom to receive information, if you have the freedom to receive information, then we can't be prevented from accessing a book in the library that a librarian has deemed appropriate or reading a book in a class that a teacher has deemed appropriate. We are free to receive that information. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this political moment is that many people have perceived the conservative party, the Republican Party in America, to be the party of freedom, of liberty. I don't want big government. I don't want to be taxed. I don't want to be told that I can't own or carry a gun. But that movement of liberty and freedom, going into schools and saying, you can't have this book in my child's classroom or in my child's school, seems to be sort of going against this message of freedom that we've been hearing for a long time. So I do think this is an exciting moment to think about what freedom is, freedom to and freedom from. And I think in some ways, the freedom to receive information protects, if that was enshrined in our Constitution, it would protect us from the kinds of bans and challenges we're seeing so frequently right now.
Yeah, it's a really thorny issue, though, because even if Congress doesn't make any law or the government doesn't make any laws, there's still society which can kind of chill free speech. For example, cancel culture.
Yeah, I put cancel culture at the very end of the class and kind of save it for the last week, because I find that 18 to 22-year-olds are pretty comfortable with the idea that we shouldn't be banning and challenging books, but are maybe more interested in canceling as a project. So I try to have us spend the whole semester looking critically at book banning and then thinking about what's the difference and what's the similarity. And I think I study the history of consumer activism, the history of boycotts. So I sort of put canceling a little bit more on the side of consumer culture. I don't want to read J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, somebody might say. Then you have kind of extreme versions of that where people were destroying their Keurigs sometime in the last few years, because I think Keurig had a progressive advertising message but the idea, like, I'm not going to buy this product because of what the product represents or because of what the author did and I don't agree with it. So I'm okay with consumer activism. I think it's fine. I do find that the accusation that somebody has been canceled tends to be overblown, in the sense that a lot of so-called canceled people still have their platforms. I do think it's really interesting when it crosses over into labor. So I think the case I'm thinking of is the case of Amy Cooper, who met an African-American man named Chris Cooper in Central Park. She had her dog with her in an area where you're not supposed to have dogs because it's a bird area. He said, "Could you please take your dog out of here so I can watch birds?" And she videoed him saying that, and she threatened to, she actually did call the police and say, "There's an African-American man threatening me in the Ramble." I think that was the name of the area of the park. She was fired from her job. Should people lose their jobs because they were caught being racist and idiotic on social media? I don't know. That's a hard question for me. You do not have free speech at work. 100%. And I think, again, people come into my class thinking, oh, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want, wherever I want. Your employer can fire you for what you say. So I do get really interested in kind of the layers and contradictions that come out when you start thinking about the similarities and the differences between banned books and cancel culture.
Taking it back a little closer to banned books, people can also be fired for perhaps giving a child access to a book. So I feel like that also verges onto labor.
It does. Teachers and librarians are just under so much duress right now for being in the public eye around these issues. They are getting threatened with arrest, more kind of garden variety bullying, death threats, digital harassment, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm definitely against that. I mean, I think these are professionals who have training in how to tell if a book is actually age appropriate. And I am someone who is very likely to trust professionals in this situation. I mean, granted, I am a professional teacher myself, but I am not paid by the state of Pennsylvania. I am paid by the undergraduates of Carnegie Mellon. So I do think that people are really having to become heroes when they just went to school to be a teacher or a librarian. And it's really tough right now for those folks.
I feel like, for example, the American Library Association, by hosting Banned Books Week, is somewhat seen to have taken a political side.
I think the ALA, organizations like PEN America, if you look at their public rhetoric, I mean, they are very careful to say that they're against book bans, no matter who is launching it. I know in California, progressive parents have banded together to challenge books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Huckleberry Finn, again, for, inadequately respectful portrayals of African Americans and use of the N-word. So you could say that was a liberal or left book ban. I think that when I look at the numbers, they just don't compare in a balanced way. So at least right now, I would say liberals are not going about the work of book banning and challenging to the extent that conservatives are.
Well, conservatives seem, per my observations, to be a bit more uptight about sexuality in texts.
I think something like 80 to 90% of most book challenges come around the question of obscenity, age appropriateness, portrayals of sex and sexuality. So I think as we've had a real, what I see is real positive movement in having more public gay authors telling queer stories, there has been, I think, a conservative backlash against that. I think there is a fear, and I don't think this fear even has like a politics per se, that your kids might learn something at school that will lead them to do something you don't want them to do. And I know that, you know, that's something I've struggled with as a parent. You know, especially public schools, like ideally they're going to be exposed to thoughts, ideas, authors, points of view that aren't available in a single family. To my mind, that's the whole point of the project of public education. And, you know, something when we were talking before about free speech and rights, I think one of the things that the Constitution doesn't tell us how to do is what happens when my right to free speech interferes with, say, some other right that I might possess. So I do think that we don't have a formula. We don't have a mathematical formula for figuring out whose rights trump other people's rights. Maybe you could answer a question for me, which is when you started the banned books class last fall, like, what was your thought on kind of the issue, and how did that change over the course of the semester? How are you thinking about it now?
I'm from Chicago, so originally I thought, well, you know, that doesn't happen here, which isn't actually true even. And people who are banning books are just doing it because they feel that they can't control their children. But I feel like I did gain more sympathy for the perspective. Even if I don't necessarily agree with banning books, I do see why, well, age appropriateness, I would leave it to the professionals, but I do see the arguments for that being a major problem.
Yeah, I'm happy you said that, because I do challenge my students every fall to try and imagine some scenario in their life. I mean, you know, most of you aren't really even at the point where you're even thinking about having children. I think that something really changed for me when I had kids. You know, I just saw the education system differently than when I was in it myself. So to imagine some kind of scenario where you might really disagree with somebody who wants to teach your kid something. So I think I do encourage everybody to try to empathize and take the position of, and imagine being so upset about something that you could get very political about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I've got Professor Kathy Newman here with me. We were talking about banned books. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It was lovely to speak with you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archon Das, and today we're here with...
Erica Hyde. I'm a senior park ranger for the city of Pittsburgh. I work out of the Department of Public Safety.
And we're here to learn a little bit more about the deer management program in the city of Pittsburgh. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course.
So tell us a little bit more. What is the deer management program?
Yeah, so the deer management program is a effort to control the overpopulation of white-tailed deer in the city of Pittsburgh limits, specifically looking into our parks, which will then result in benefits for our local residents around parks and throughout the city as a whole. So we were approached by a group of citizens within a neighborhood organization, primarily within the Friends of Riverview Park, which is up in the north side of Pittsburgh. And that was also joined by the Squirrel Hill Urban Coalition. And they kind of merged together and formed a group of concerned citizens, specifically between their two organizations, but also citywide, that were complaining about the effects of deer, primarily across the city, eating their vegetation, potentially being in vehicle collisions with deer. And they wanted to take that effort and that interest and formulate it into a deer management program. So when we met with them, we were basically just the people to help get that legislation through and also formulate a deer management program that was effective, but primarily safe for all of our parkgoers and citizens visiting the city of Pittsburgh. So,
sure. Within the deer management program, I think when most people think about a word like deer management, you're thinking about what seems like sort of science-y methods, sterilizing deer and such. Mm-hmm. But the deer management program in Pittsburgh actually involves hunting. Can you talk a little bit more about why that choice was made?
We evaluated both non-lethal and lethal methods for deer management as a whole. So we very early on looped in the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to help us through this process. They are experts in it. They've been running deer management programs for way longer than we have. We also looked at other parks around us that match kind of our, you know, demographic and our acreage and whatnot. So we really like Cincinnati's model, and we basically took Cincinnati's model, worked with the USDA, made a couple tweaks here and there, and we came up with our solution. So right now in Pennsylvania, you cannot legally do any sort of non-lethal deer management. It's primarily, the big thing is it's not going to help handle the deer population that we have as of today. We are already overabundant. If we put in non-lethal methods, one, they're not going to be very effective. Two, they're going to be extremely expensive, but three, they're not going to handle the deer population we have right at this minute, and we need to bring that population down to a sustainable level before we could even consider any sort of non-lethal options. But in the state of Pennsylvania, we can't do that. We can't do sterilization. We can't do trap and relocation, and we cannot do a birth control. It's not FDA regulated or approved in the Pennsylvania region. So we chose a lethal method. It was both cost-effective. We could do some really great things with it, like donating to local food pantries and whatnot. And also, it was handling the deer population that we had at this moment as a whole. So that is why we went with a lethal method versus the non-lethal method.
Cool. So you're a park ranger. What's the involvement of the park rangers in this program?
Yeah, so we are working in our parks every day. We're seeing the effects of overpopulation in terms of an environmental stance. So we're looking at the issues of an agricultural but also landscape issue. We're seeing our understory that's basically depleted. If you go, I don't know, Schenley's a great example. It's a local park here. If you go to Schenley and you're in the woods, you're on the bridle trail, you shouldn't be able to see clear to the Greenfield Road. You shouldn't be able to clearly see up to the Schenley Oval. We should have an understory. So I always tell people that go camping, go hiking. If you ever go up to McConnell's Mills, you see those lovely rhododendron forests. They're thick, but you can't see up to the next trail because that understory is so thick. Here in Pittsburgh, we don't have that. And that's because of the deer population. Our deer are hungry. They need food, and they're going to eat those understory covers. And without an understory, without a healthy understory, we're going to start seeing an increase in stormwater runoff and potentially even like landslides that lead to this. It's all basically a spiral of a demise. And when you add deer, an overabundance of deer as a whole to it, you're basically taking gasoline and pouring it on the fire. So this is one thing that we can manage now and help out our ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I've walked through Schenley Park many times. We live right next to the park. And I guess I never noticed that the sort of lack of vegetation on the ground is because of those deer. But you're saying that's like a major factor causing mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, it's a major, you know, it's a major issue in Pittsburgh parks as a whole. And, you know, if you ever walk through the park and you see new vegetation being put in or any sort of new trees, you see tree protection going on. You see tree tubes, you see tree caging, even deer fences and deer enclosures that are installed all throughout Frick Park to, you know, give these trees a chance to even grow up, because
our saplings can't grow without some sort of protection to keep them safe from the deer. And that even results in just natural seeding of the forest floor. You know, trees drop seeds, seeds hit the ground. Hypothetically, they grow new trees. Not in Pittsburgh, because the deer are right there to grab that sapling the minute it sprouts and eat it.
Yes. Cool. I'm sure a lot of people, after hearing this, maybe have the knee-jerk reaction that, oh, there's people, you know, shooting guns and bows and arrows in my parks. But from what I understand, it's a very well-controlled and safe thing to do. Could you tell me a little bit more about the safety measures in place for this program?
Yeah. So for archery, everything that we do in our program has to be in line with the PA Game Commission, their regulations. And then in addition, we can add more measures to that as well. So anytime you're dealing with archery, you have to be 50 yards away from any occupied dwelling. So that's any sort of houses or whatnot. And then in addition to that, we added on playgrounds, dog parks, major amenities that we wouldn't want an archer to have to, you know, deal with, conflicting with by any means. Archery has been happening for years in all around us. Allegheny County Parks has had a program that has had archers in it, in North Park, South Park, whatnot, for before I was born, before you were born, probably. So it's archery happens. It's happening all over, and it's a safe. We have a great track record from the Game Commission of hunting-related shooting incident reports from the last 20 years showing that archery is safe, especially for bystanders. The only injuries that typically occur from archery occur when there are alcoholic beverages involved or multiple archers, so or potentially falling out of your tree stand. Those were the three most common incidents that happen. So we did not allow our archers any sort of alcoholic beverages, obviously, and they had to hunt alone. So we didn't have that issue of being, you know, distracted by your friend or, you know, goofing off potentially. They had to hunt solo. And these archers, as they showed in their accuracy test, they've been out hunting before. They are very, you know, well-equipped with knowledge and the skills to handle this.
So has there been a noticeable decrease in the deer population? And how do you guys monitor this sort of thing?
It is tricky to study a population that is so transient and can move such a far distance. So we did not do a population study. We do not have a recent one because it would tell us we're overpopulated. You should not be able to go through a hike in Schenley Park and see 50 deer and be like, oh, another deer. You should be excited to see deer. A lot of times the number 20 to 30 deer per square mile is the quota that they look for. So that's one frick park, 20 to 30 deer. I saw 20 to 30 deer in 1 hour out on the trails in like one section of frick park. So we know we're overpopulated. There was no reason to do a study at that time. So we didn't.
You mentioned that there were different stakeholders in this program, the USDA, the city, different community groups. Could you just walk us through who are all of the different stakeholders and what's sort of their involvement in the program?
Yeah, so I work for the city of Pittsburgh. So the park rangers are lumped in the Department of Public Safety. We are currently managing the deer management program on the city side of things. So we're also dealing with public complaints, any sort of, you know, decision-making is coming from the Department of Public Safety with assistance of City Council. Now, the USDA is a federal entity, and they're the ones proposing the contract, and it's signing through, you know, City Council with our opinions on it.
The deer management program runs during the winter. As far as, I don't know a lot about hunting, I'm not like a hunting guy, but I always thought that it was during the winter in order to maintain the deer population. Is there a particular reason that the program is running through the winter and not, say, during the summer?
So once again, that's a state game, you know, game commission requirement. So we cannot change the dates. Our dates are set by county, and that's from the PA Game Commission. So they're always in the fall. My assumption, and I am not a hunter as well, my assumption is it has to deal with raising fawns. So obviously we don't want to take, you know, potentially a mother from a fawn at that phase. So this is before mating really begins.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. The archery program is finished for this year, right?
Correct.
Has it been a successful year, and where do you see it growing in the future?
So the archery program is completed right now. I believe it was a great success. We had zero public safety incidents. We harvested 199 deer in total, and we donated 14,720 meals to those in need,
wow,
which is amazing. And with that, we're hoping to expand. We are finishing up the targeted harvesting now. We're going to debrief internally and with the downtown team, and we're going to see where we can expand to next season. So we're hopeful to see this program grow into a citywide program as we are starting to develop it into our five main parks, but hopefully more in the future. So
awesome. There was another part of the program that I found interesting. The first deer harvested by any archer has to be a doe. Could you tell me a little bit more about the reasoning behind that rule?
We require the first one to be harvested as a doe because we want the archers that are in our program to have the same mindset as we want this to be conservation driven. We want this to be, you know, population control driven. And we want to see some good come from this program. So if you're not willing to donate that first year, maybe this program isn't meant for you.
Walking around Pittsburgh, you also see a lot of forested areas that aren't necessarily parks, and presumably there are also deer living there. Are you guys planning on targeting any of those areas, or how do you approach that problem?
Yeah, so we are, I say as a city, we're putting our toes in the puddle of deer management. There's so many options, so many ways you can go about it, and the ways you can expand this program is endless, but we have to start somewhere. So right now it was focusing on our larger parks that are typically residents for these deer. You know, they might wander out into the streets of Oakland, but where are they going? They're going back to Schenley Park probably to rest, you know, and resume, you know, their daily operations. But we can expand it. We can expand it to local greenways. We can even look into, I know the USDA does some work with residential owners. Like, there's so many options to expand a deer management program that we can look into. But right now we're only in year two, which is, you know, a great start. That's what we like to see. But we don't want to expand too fast. We want to, you know, work our way up to it.
So after doing a little bit of digging on the deer management program, I read about this new pilot program that's in place this year where there's like a targeted harvest with sharpshooters. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about that pilot program?
Yeah. So last year we introduced archery. This year we introduced archery in more parks, but we also added in a targeted harvesting aspect to the program. And targeted harvesting is only happening in Frick Park and Riverview Park up in the north side. It is contracted out by the USDA, so it's only USDA contracted employees that are coming in at night and they're removing deer. They are removing deer with firearms. They are suppressed, and they are doing this at night. So our parks are closed at 11 p.m. I don't know about you, but I'm not out past, you know, 8 p.m., but they're starting closer to, like, they're starting at 11 p.m. or later, and they are working throughout the night. And they are off-site, out of sight by 6 a.m. when the parks reopen.
How many hunters are out there for the targeted harvesting program?
So it is just a one vehicle unit that is operating. So there are three guys within one truck, someone spotting, someone driving, and then someone shooting. And they are obviously using thermals and nighttime vision to make sure that they have clean, safe shots before they ever take them.
I feel like that's like an interesting image to have in one's head of like a sort of squad that's just out there to shoot deer. So what have been some of the community reactions to this program?
Yeah.
You mentioned that there was some involvement from community organizations at the beginning.
Yeah, I would say I started this job in 2017, and I would say there was no way that we would have ever gotten a deer management program off the ground. The public was just not to that level of caring about the deer population. And in the last, you know, 5 years, I've seen so many complaints, and the Gandy administration finally was like, we're going to do something about these complaints. We're going to handle the complaints about deer coming into our yards, eating all of our gardens. You know, how many vehicle collisions we've had over the past, you know, 20 years, just increasing. So the public really kind of fueled this program. Like, they were a large part of getting this program up and off the ground. So a lot of complaints that we had were more like curiosity. Like, how do I know that this is safe? I don't want to see an archer. You know, I bring my kid there to the playground. Like, I don't want them to be exposed to this. And a lot of it was more just like, once you sat down and explained the program, everyone was totally understanding. And they want to see something happen with the deer population. They might be upset that it's a lethal control method, but once they understand that non-lethal is not an option at this moment, they're usually okay with it.
Could you talk a little bit more about the effects of the deer population on the plant life in the area?
Yeah, for sure. So, as I said, you know, deer eat a lot, like 7 pounds of food a day. That's a lot of food for, you know, Pitt did a study saying that they looked at the more economical side of deer management, but they made this prediction looking at prior studies that we might have up to 300 deer in Frick Park at a time. Take 300 and times it by 7. That's a lot of food being eaten every single day. So when deer are eating, they're munching on the, we'll say the native vegetation is the what they prefer. That's what they want. They want our gardens. They want, you know, our local or our native flora. So when they eat that and they remove it from the ground, because typically they pull and rip and they take the roots and everything with it, that leaves an open spot in our forest floor. Traditionally, what would happen is native seeds or whatnot would come in and fill that and hypothetically fill that void. But when we have 300 deer doing that at the same time, we're left with major gaps in our forest floor. So our ground has these gaps, and what's going to move in and fill that? It's probably going to be something that is deer resistant and traditionally an invasive species. So that's one of the reasons that we see things like garlic mustard, we see Japanese knotweed, and we see these species thriving in our parks because the deer aren't eating them. Nothing wants to eat them. So it's hard to replace once you start getting into, we're starting to spiral into more invasive predominant forest versus a native-based forest. And once you start that spiral, it's really hard to catch up. It's really, really hard to catch up. So we're seeing our native forest being replaced with more of an invasive-based forest cover or understory that the deer are not eating. And they're flourishing. They're doing great. But on the other hand, we see a deer population that's hungry, that's starving, and they're now starting to resort to moving out into the streets into risky environments or potentially even munching on invasive species that we have never seen them eat before. I saw a deer munching on Japanese knotweed in the middle of the summer, but that's what the food source was available for them.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course.
After speaking with Erica, we wanted to learn a little bit more from the perspective of the archers who participate in this program. We're catching up with one of them today, Walter Martin. Thanks for coming on the show, Walter.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I am an avid outdoorsman. I love being outside. I love hiking. I love going into national parks. I like fishing. And I like archery hunting. So I love being outside. I love watching nature.
Sure. How'd you get into hunting and archery in the first place?
You know, I was, I used to be in a business development position in the golf industry. And with that, I was a lot of the places I would go, golf courses, were in areas that were, you know, woods, nice habitats. And they would talk about hunting and being like somebody who loved the outside. I just started to learn like what they were doing and I got involved.
So do you only hunt with bow and arrow or do you also hunt with guns?
I have only hunted with bow and arrow. So the bow and arrow season, the archery season is from September through November. And so it's a beautiful time of the year to be in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So on the deer management program, I guess, how did you hear about the program in the first place?
So as you... you know, follow, you know, on Facebook, there's sites and pages that are dedicated to archery hunting. And it just came up in one of the groups. So I applied for it. You know, one of the challenges with archery hunting is trying to find places to hunt and also places that are convenient.
Awesome. And within the city, where do you hunt? Which parks?
I hunt Frick Park.
Frick Park. Awesome.
So Frick Park, it's split up into 10 different zones, and a hunter is assigned to each zone.
Okay, so you can only hunt within the zone that you're assigned?
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense. So on a typical day when you're in the field hunting, just like walk us through your process. Like, what do you do to prepare when you're at home? When you show up, what do you do to set up? And like, what's it like? What kinds of hours are you maybe normally out there?
Since... you know, archery is fun and a sport, like we practice. So like really, when does it start? It starts in the spring as you practice and just keep getting better and better at being archery and figuring out what you can do and what you can't do is what your limitations are. So it starts really with practicing and like moving forward as the season comes close. I would take walks in Frick Park around the area that I was planning to hunt and like see if I could see deer movement, see if I could see trails and prepare for that. If you're talking about like day of, like, you know, usually on Sunday, which is a non-hunting day throughout the state, I like, we'll just double check my equipment to make sure that everything's fine and I'll just practice a little more. And then I'll have my gear in my vehicle like the day of. I'll show up maybe, you know, if it's early morning, I'll show up before the sun comes up and leave by, you know, an hour or two after the sun's up. I try to walk in with civilian clothing on, not camo. I carry a backpack and I have my hunting clothes in that. The bow, I hunt with both a compound bow and a crossbow. I carry those in a bag as a big a plastic black bag. I pick up trash on the way and I just try to not make anybody nervous. So like my pre-hunt, that's basically it. I do have trail cameras out there when they're allowed 2 weeks before the season starts.
Hunting deer in Frick Park is a little bit unique in that it's in the city instead of, you know, in a more suburban or rural area like most hunting that I think people are aware of. What are some of the differences between hunting in Frick Park and hunting sort of out in the woods in the middle of nowhere?
The deer feel bubbles of safety. And like on the trails, they know they're humans. And like the deer have been very comfortable around people. They were a lot more 2 years ago when it started than they are right now. But if you were within what they would consider their bubbles of safety, like in between the trails, in the woods, like they would get spooked when they saw people in places they didn't normally see people. I mean, that part's different. I think the real key is the approach to hunting. First off, safety is number one. So when we're scouting our territory, it's okay, this is going to be a good spot that's not going to endanger anybody. But we definitely know, okay, this is, I can shoot uphill here. If I'm shooting in an elevated position, the arrow's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fly. It's not like a gunshot, like a bullet that can travel a long distance. I don't think people realize we really don't shoot over 20, 25 yards.
Oh, pretty short.
Yeah, it's pretty short. And that's another huge difference in urban hunting. And especially with Frick Park and especially with this program, shot selection's unbelievably important. We have to look for a double lung shot that's going to put the deer down really, like, down quickly. In the wild, I've shot a deer that the arrow passed through its heart, and I think it still ran 80, 90 yards. If we're hunting in an urban environment and there's houses, you know, 80 yards can mean three or four houses. 80 yards can mean it runs towards the soccer field that the kids are practicing on.
Are you guys responsible for dressing the deer?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
So they have a station at all the parks where you would remove the deer and then field dress the deer.
Is this your first year in the program?
Second year.
Have you noticed any decrease in the number of deer?
Absolutely.
Okay.
A huge difference. The first year, deer would almost follow me in the woods. Yeah. Like, they were so docile. And there were so many of them. It's definitely dropped down.
So if you could nerd out a little bit, what gear do you bring on your hunts? What kind of bow?
So I have two types of bow, two bows that I bring. One is a Bowtech compound bow, and that's, you know, and one is a crossbow. Crossbows have higher power, and I think it has more downing. Like, it's, you know, for double long shots, it's probably something that would help put the deer down as soon as possible.
Could you talk a little bit more about the testing process? Do they take you out to a range somewhere? Or?
We go to a range. You know, there's targets set up. You don't know in advance what your target.